Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the online course for the NASM CPT. My name is Eddie Lester, here to take you through the PowerPoint lecture for Chapter 10. So Chapter 10, we're going to be getting into program design. So basically, this is the chapter in which NASM is going to kind of direct you and guide you into how to start to put together a program for a potential client. And the options here are going to really set you up to understand how the different acute variables that are associated with program design, as well, which are the most important part of program design, as well as the other elements that you need to consider when thinking about each individual client. So let's go ahead and start on slide number 2. And specifically, we're going to talk about the progressive program design and the OPT model. So the OPT model, once again, is NASM's starting point for you guys to create a fitness program. And that's the phase 1 through phase 5, the stabilization, strength, and power stages. And it's a really good and probably one of the most accepted, we'll say, models of programming that is around in the fitness industry. And most of NASM's backing is really behind this model because they've done the research to prove that it works and is safe and effective. And that's the most important thing when you're thinking about training clients. So the OPT model is designed with acute variables programmed into it according to the needs of different individuals. And specifically, it's according to the needs of the goals of the individuals. The needs or goals of individuals. Specifically, those goals are around, well, the five main goals of fitness are going to be stabilization, strength, and power, or a little bit more focused on like stabilization, endurance, strength, endurance. Then you have your hypertrophy, your maximal strength, and then your power. So those are the main key elements of performance in fitness. And NASM created the OPT model to help you get clients through that. Obviously, clients may have a goal such as weight loss, but you need to be effective in the stabilization area to also or to go along with your weight loss goal. So next bullet point says the progressive resistance exercise, which is a method for increasing the ability of muscles to generate force. So you're always progressing and creating certain exercises is important to create adaptations within the muscle, and that allows for further, we'll say, strength, further stabilization to be achieved as you progress your client down in the OPT model. So it says progressions are divided up to support each component of the integrated fitness training. All right, so let's move over to slide number 3. So the progressive program design further, we're going to talk about acute variables. And acute variables are the numbers that you're going to put behind an entire program. So what I mean by numbers is basically how many sets, how many reps, how many all that sort of stuff, which NASM really gets into in the next chapters. But specifically, the first acute variables that NASM wants you to know is going to be volume first, which is the amount of work performed in a training session. So what was the volume of work that you did? A volume can be measured in anywhere from like reps times sets times weight, like how much weight did you move? Can be done as in how many total sets did you do? NASM kind of relies more on the total sets performed per body part for volume. The next acute variable is going to be tempo. Tempo is the speed at which each repetition is performed, and specifically they list it with 3 different numbers, which is going to be a eccentric, isometric, and concentric, which is the 4-2-1, 4 seconds eccentric, 2 seconds isometric, and 1 second concentric. So, or a 202, which is 2 seconds eccentric, 0 seconds of a pause or an isometric, and then 2 seconds concentric. Those are going to describe the way that you're doing tempo. So if you have a 4-2-1 tempo, that's a 7 second rep. That's better for stabilization. A slower controlled tempo is better for stabilization. That's why NASM list that 4-2-1 in the stabilization phase of training. That's the suggested tempo. Then you also have a 202 tempo, which is more in that strength phase or a hypertrophy phase specifically, in which it's controlled, but it's a little bit faster, which is 4 seconds per rep. And then you can go as fast as possible, you know, but, or you could do 1-1-1. You could mix that up with any numbers that you want, but NASM doesn't want you to know what their model suggests, which is 421, 202, and then XXX, which is XXX is just as fast as possible. Yeah, perfect. So we went over the three bullet points below that. Next acute variable is going to be load. Load is going to be the amount of weight lifted or resistance during training. So specifically with load, you're basically just looking at what weight did you lift? How much weight did you lift? And obviously a lighter weight is better for beginning stages of training. It's better for beginners because that's going to help develop endurance. It's going to help develop stabilization and coordination. The heavier the weight, the more it leans towards that strength and sort of power or one rep, we'll say maximal strength category, which is a different adaptation, potentially maybe more for those athletes or looking to gain muscle or looking just to become as strong as possible. Next, we're going to have training intensity, and training intensity is basically they consider it like the level of effort usually expressed as a percentage of your one rep maximum. So it's kind of like a load. It is basically a load. Like for instance, if you're going to do 70% of your one rep max weight, that's basically considered a load. Training intensity is typically, it's not like the intensity of which your heart rate is. It's actually more referring to the load again. But NASM likes to never really say, this is how much you should lift. It's basically a training intensity, which is a level of a one rep max, typically. And then you have your rest period. Rest period is going to be the rest in between sets. So the time taken in between sets for you to recover. And recovery is important. Which we're going to talk about as we move into slide number 4. Rest is important because certain amounts of rest promote different adaptations. For instance, if you're looking to lift something as heavy as possible, you're going to want to rest for a long time so that you have all of the energy available to push really, really hard 1 to 2 times, maybe up to 5 times. If you're looking to build coordination and endurance, you're going to want to rest a shorter amount of time and continuously for longer periods of time because that mimics more endurance work. So let's talk about it really quick. For muscular endurance and stabilization, or basically phase 1 and 2 of the OPT model, you're going to want to go to 0 to 90 seconds of rest. So 0 means you're supersetting and there's no rest in between. 90 seconds means it's a minute and a half in between sets. Then NASM goes to hypertrophy, and NASM's research basically shows, and most people agree, that a short rest period when hitting one muscle group is going to enhance the ability of that muscle group to grow in size. So NASM, the shortest rest period for all phases is actually going to be hypertrophy, which is a 0 to 60 second period. So if you guys are looking to gain muscle and you have been trying to and haven't been as effective or want to switch things up, try not resting longer than 60 seconds ever when you're hitting the same body part. And you know, obviously that's going to reflect the amount of weight you can lift. So don't worry if you can't quite lift as much weight when you rest 3 to 5 minutes compared to when you rest 30 seconds or something. But it really puts a lot of stress on the adaptation of the muscle fiber to store fuel, and that increases the amount of tear because it's less rest, and the muscle has to provide more fuel and that it doesn't have. So it shocks the muscle into really, we'll say, storing more fuel, which makes it larger, as well as the muscle damage is higher because it's more work over a shorter period of time, higher intensity. Fun facts. Give that a try. Next, we have maximal strength. Maximal strength. So since the goal of maximal strength is to lift something 1 to 5 times as heavy as possible, you want to rest in between sets for as long as you need to get a full store or restore of energy, which is 3 to 5 minutes. Typically around 3 minutes is totally fine, but unless you're going for that one last huge set or huge rep, a huge rep or set, that is, you know, you really want to make sure you perform your greatest, then you may go all the way to that 5 minute mark. But beyond that, it's about the same. Typically around 3 minutes is when you get 100% recovery of ATP, which we'll go over in this next one below. And power is the same way. We really, 3 to 5 minutes rest for power is important because you want to push 1 or 2 times, maybe up to 10 times as hard as you possibly can. So you want to rest for that longer period of time to have the best performance in that. All right, so percentages of ATP recovery. So this is going to be important because there's a reason why certain rest periods and certain phases, or sorry, there's a reason why certain phases have specific rest periods. like I kind of said, if you want to focus on endurance, you want to not recover fully. You want to continue to push that muscle so that it's forced to work for a longer period of time. So that's 20 to 30 seconds of rest provides about 50% of ATP recovery. Okay, 50% of ATP recovery is not that much, but luckily, since you aren't lifting super heavy weight, with 20 to 30 seconds rest, you can typically push through. This is where you get a ton of muscle burn, upwards of that 15 to 20 rep range, that sort of thing, shorter rest periods, and push, lots of muscle burn. 40 seconds is about 75% of ATP recovery, and that's important to know. All of these typically can show up on the test, so we do want you to know all of these. But yeah, 40 seconds provides 75% of ATP recovery. I like to use 40 to 45 seconds for hypertrophy. I feel like that's you get a little bit extra than a 30-second rest, and you get a little bit more ATP recovery, so you can still perform pretty dang well. A lot of times I'll do anywhere from 40 to 45 seconds. Sometimes I'll do a minute at a time, but I do kind of like pushing myself, making the workouts a little bit quicker. And I love that 40-second to 45-second rest period, which is a recovery of about 75% of ATP, which allows you to still push pretty good with some of the weight during hypertrophy or muscle gain programs. All right, next is the 60 seconds, which has 85 to 90% of ATP recovery. So all of a sudden, in 60 seconds, you almost have a full recovery of your muscle's ATP. Not quite full, but a good amount. So NASM says that's where you want that hypertrophy maximum, below 60 seconds. To really push that muscle to work and to grow. So next is, and final one is going to be 3 minutes or more, 3 to 5 minutes is where you get about 100% recovery of ATP. And that's why you should wait that long for the power and maximal strength, because you have your entire recovery of ATP to push really, really heavy and that have a full recovery. So definitely know those for the test, and then let's go ahead and move over to slide number 5. All right, so further with acute variables and program design, so there's a few more that we're going to go over. So exercise selection is important. You aren't going to do a one rep max on one foot with a cable, okay, ever. No one's doing a single leg cable overhead press for one rep ever, or even 5 reps. So exercise selection is important because you want to make sure that what you're promoting with the phase of training aligns with the type of exercise that you're doing. For instance, in the maximal, let's say in the stabilization phase, you doing a really heavy bench press doesn't really make sense. You can do a bench press in the stabilization phase, but it's a pretty stable exercise, so it doesn't make too much sense. What you could do as opposed to a bench press is maybe put yourself in the same position but on a stability ball. So in a glute bridge on a stability ball. That requires a lot more stabilization. Therefore, that's more appropriate for the stabilization phase. NASM will quiz you on exercise selection in the sense that it'll say something like, which of the following exercises best fits in the stabilization phase of training? And you need to know that typically things with a stability ball or on one leg or not being seated is more towards the stable elements, those are going to be geared towards stabilization. So, but then the seated exercises are going to be geared more towards strength and or power. Depends on what type of move you're doing, but standing and or on one leg or an unstable surface, that's definitely all geared towards stabilization. That's like the main point that I want you guys to draw from exercise selection. All right, next we have order of exercises. And specifically with order of exercises, you want to understand that you should prioritize according to the client's needs and training goals, meaning that, I guess just to give an example of an order of exercise sort of thing, is that if you're doing undulating training in the sense that you're doing some strength training with some stabilization training, you're typically going to want to perform the strength training first, because that's a lot harder and higher intensity, we'll say, because you're lifting heavier weights and you don't want to be really fatigued and then go lift heavy weights because you did the stabilization exercise ahead of the strength exercise. So in phase 2, you want to understand that supersetting a strength followed by a stabilization exercise is more appropriate than the other way around because of that. Order of exercises, you always want to, this is from Eddie, you always want to prioritize what's most important to that client. So let's say the client says, oh, I'd rather have bigger biceps than triceps. Well, then that day, if you're working out arms, you're going to perform biceps before you go perform triceps. So yeah, that just kind of sets you up to understand the most important thing should come first. Next, we got periodization. Periodization, which we've hopefully talked about a little bit before, but periodization is going to be the division of a training program into smaller progressive stages, meaning that you never are going to do one program for a year. You're always going to break up that training or break up a year-long training program into different phases and different stages about every 4 weeks. Okay, so about 12 programs a year is appropriate, and yeah, so periodization. We'll talk a little bit more as we get down through this PowerPoint. But there's different types of periodization. Linear periodization is basically going to get someone from high reps and low weight all the way through training with higher weight and lower reps, meaning you're going straight from phase one to phase two to phase three to phase four to phase five in a nice, easy, we'll say, linear style. Okay. Or basically linear periodization is also, if you think about it in one program, you're training in one phase only for each individual 4 week program. You're not bouncing around from, some high weight stuff and some low weight stuff. You're actually staying strictly within the rep ranges of, we'll say, phase one, that sort of thing. Rep ranges and set ranges. But then if we go over to the next slide, we have undulating periodization. Undulating periodization is basically going to be in which you bounce around from different phases, either in one program, or you go, from phase one to phase four, or from a four-week program in phase one to a four-week program in phase four, then to a four-week program in phase two, then to a four-week program in phase three, then back to one, and jumping around the OPT model. Either or, linear or undulating periodization is totally fine. I actually like to go more with the undulating periodization just because it shocks the body a little bit more and doesn't like slowly progress in a linear style. It kind of just like, whoa, that's really heavy. Oh, that's really light. And it really helps the body work and become or hold adaptations within what my goals are, which is to be, I surf a lot and play volleyball, which requires a good amount of endurance, but it also requires a good amount of power and strength, especially in volleyball, to jump in as high as I can. I never want to do a ton of stabilization work or only stabilization work and endurance work, because I still want to jump high. So alternating from phase four to phase one to phase two and then back to phase five and then to four, things like that really help me to maintain endurance while also maintaining a power in my jumping and things like that. So that's kind of how undulating periodization works and why you might use it over linear periodization. But most clients are completely fine with linear periodization, and it's actually a good 5 month program would be phase one through phase five. Obviously, if those phases hit the goals that the client wants. So just keep that in mind. And like I said, kind of at the bottom, or that last bullet point under undulating periodization, it's training in multiple phases in one program can also be considered undulating periodization, in the sense that in one program, I'm doing 5 rep max squats, and then I immediately follow those five rep max squats with 3 sets of burnout lunges in the 15 to 20 rep range or something. That right there is 2 different repetition ranges in one program. But it's not all from one phase, it's from multiple phases, so that's considered undulating periodization. All right, also client homework, factors to consider. This is just NASM typically wants your clients to be given homework. Homework is great, especially if you're only seeing the client 2 to 3 times a week, 1 to 2 times per week. You want to make sure they're always being active towards their goals. Factors to consider, attitudes toward homework. Do they want to work out aside from being with you? If not, then you need to encourage that they're there with you more frequently. Their goals and then the difficulty of achieving their goals. If they're looking to do, 20 pounds in a month, they better be freaking doing exercise outside of working with you. what's the difficulty of their goals, that sort of thing. And you also want to avoid negative connotations that come with the term homework. Like, don't give them like an hour of grueling treadmill work. Say maybe, hey, you're looking to lose weight. What if you went and played with your kids for an hour at the park, 2 nights a week, or ran around and kicked the soccer ball with your kids, or you know, find out a sport that they love and tell them to do that, as opposed to just like play tennis this week or something. You don't want to be like, oh, that's I'm not looking forward to waking up at 6 a.m. and walking on the treadmill for an hour. That's terrible. Well, for most people. And then also, yeah, do not overwhelm clients with homework as that is too difficult. We kind of talked about that. And start simple and periodically assess the client's readiness to take on more. Homework all depends on the client's goals. And my thought on homework, though, is I want them to be working with me as much as possible. But then if they can't afford it or they only have time for two sessions a week, they have to be doing that something outside, which is that homework that we're talking about. All right, so furthermore on program design, as we look at slide 7, we'll try to speed this along. So trainer templates and record keeping. Basically, you're going to NASM has a good template that you guys can use to write down your workouts. They also have a year or yearly programming templates, such as annual plan, which would be a macro cycle for a year. That's called a macro cycle, or programming in the macros perspective. Monthly plan would be a meso cycle, medium. Meso meaning month or medium. And then a weekly plan, which is a microcycle, like what are we going to be doing this week? And you can get a good idea of in the book what those templates look like. And those are downloadable on the NASM website. So definitely do that if you want to program yearly. But programming yearly is really more for athletes. If you get a client that wants weight loss, you aren't going to program a year out almost ever, because you don't know if they're going to be working with you for a full year unless they purchase a full year. So just keep that in mind. But athletes that have, you know, seasons, you definitely want to be focusing on, you know, specific types of training when they're in season versus out of season. All right, a monthly program, yeah, you perform objective assessments almost every month to check their improvements, okay? Especially if they're interested in weight loss and or decreasing body fat, you want to test them to see how they're doing. Weekly programming is just basically going to be what body parts and what workouts are they doing on a weekly basis. And then daily program is which body parts and per day are you going to be working out, and on what days, and that should be good. All right, moving along to slide number 8, assessments considerations and program design. Basically, we're looking at the movement efficiency. So quality of movements should be considered over quantity. That's something important that NASM wants you to know. Is basically you never want to do too much of something if they're not doing it right. I've had a few clients that just can't for some reason figure out how to keep their hips level in a push-up. So as opposed to doing more and more push-ups, we do less push-ups with better form until they start to break down. And over time, they improve to be able to hold their hips a lot straighter, and that's when we can add more quantity because the quality of the movement improves. So focus on quality before you ever start to give them more reps or more weight, for sure. So next we have our muscle imbalances that usually attributed to a client's lifestyle and daily activity. So you need to know their postural imbalances in order to design programs effectively, because you want to make sure that you don't give them an exercise that they're going to be one of the imbalances is going to be very prevalent. And then also some cardio considerations. So from different forms of cardio may place undue stress on a client's musculoskeletal system. Basically, the one that I always consider link with that in cardio is runners that just run all day, every day, and they've been doing it for a long period of time. Their knees are probably going to hurt. Their hips might even a little bit hurt. Their low back, depending on how much of what of the running they've been doing and how much distance, that's for sure. And then also another tip from that is, biking is similar to an individual who sits in a chair all day in an office. So if someone sits in a chair all day at their office and then they go do SoulCycle and they're hunched over, it's double promoting something not so good. So what that does is it may cause stress and discomfort in the low back, shoulders, and neck. So, you know, working with someone on getting retracted and pulling their head backwards and shoulders backwards is going to be a lot more important for that type of client. And you would probably want to give them something more like walking or playing a sport as opposed to biking, since it's mimicking that sitting down position. All right, over to slide 9, assessments continued with the considerations for programming. So if a client's feet turn out, you have to address that muscle imbalance in the program. That means in your flexibility or your warm-up, you should include static stretching and foam rolling. Okay. And specifically, that's just important because that's part of the flexibility continuum, is you want to make sure to lengthen muscles that are tight and strengthen muscles that are weak. So in your warm-up, this is where you do it all. So clients with an anterior pelvic tilt, same thing. Well, yes. Or so for clients with a feet turnout, you foam roll and stretch the soleus and gastrocnemius, so the calf muscles, and then you're going to strengthen the anterior tibialis, which is the front of that shin there. Next, we have the clients with anterior pelvic tilt. So the seated position with someone with an anterior pelvic tilt should be replaced with someone in an upright or standing position whenever possible. So, you know, someone with an anterior pelvic tilt should do more work standing than they should sitting, just because there's a little bit of extra stress on the back when they're sitting because of their muscle imbalance and the shortened hip flexors. All right, so then it says clients with arms falling forward or rounded posture, you have to always remind them, you know, to maintain proper posture, which is their shoulders back, ears in line with the shoulders, and their head not jutting forward. So one thing I do for those types of clients is tell them to get up from their chair every minute and do a set of wall, or every 20 minutes or so, and do a set of wall angels, which is an exercise on the wall, which you line everything in a field goal position, basically, on the wall, and then you're doing an angel style like you would in the snow. You could Google those too. Those are good. Really great for people with rounded shoulders, forward head, though, because it helps line up that posture correctly. All right, moving over to slide 10, further assessment considerations and program design. So flexibility. So once again, we're going to talk about this a little more. You always want to make sure that you include flexibility in everyone's program, regardless of if they are flexible or are not flexible. It's also a great opportunity to help improve the quality of movement through SMR and static stretching. So definitely keep that in mind. Core, you must maintain ideal alignment to avoid injury. Training your core should be done almost with every single client. Kind of depends, you know, if someone's coming in with a really strong core because they exercise and they're an athletic, you don't necessarily have to do core movements, but, you know, it's pretty important to get those at least warmed up before you begin your main workout program. All right, next is balance. And this really doesn't need to be included unless it's someone in those beginning phases, phase one, phase two. Someone that's looking to gain a bunch of muscle, you shouldn't necessarily just jump into some balance exercises because they're going to be like, hey, I don't know how much muscle this is going to help me gain standing on one leg, reaching my foot in different directions. But balance can be included and should be included, especially in the elderly populations and even youth populations, just to teach coordination and proprioception. And maintaining ideal form is essential to balance training too. So, all right, let's go ahead and move over to slide number 11. Further assessment considerations for program design. Reactive training. So reactive training is basically plyometric training. And if you are doing reactive training, which isn't necessary for everyone, especially, athletes, absolutely. Reactive training should be included, obviously depending on the sport, but most of the time, reactive training is very crucial to all land sports. So it's important to do reactive training with those sorts of athletes. I am an athlete, so I do reactive training typically in the form of box jumps and side shuffles and ice skaters, things like that, to improve my lateral mobility as well as keep myself powerful for the specific sports I like to play. But also, you need to make sure that you take into account the movement compensation. So you shouldn't be doing reactive training unless you've properly lengthened the muscles that are tight. Because you don't want to have someone jumping and their knees are caving in while they're doing jumps or things like that. That's the main one that NASM always talks about. All right, resistance training. OBT model phase one will primarily focus on form and decreasing movement compensations. So based on the different phases, you're going to be focusing on certain things, obviously. And by the time the clients reach phase five, they should be able to maintain form with less conscious thought. That's in that linear periodization as you go from phase one through phase five. Basically you're teaching the client coordination, and coordination and fitness, it does take a little bit. And especially if someone's not used to doing certain or not used to working out, they're not going to have a really good idea of how to hold their body in certain areas. So you really wouldn't want to move someone towards the phase four or phase five unless they can really have good coordination. And most athletes do, which is good. But, you know, people off the street, maybe deconditioned, out of shape people, might not be able to hold certain posture or form correctly. So going into phase four, phase five might not be too appropriate. So be aware of that. All right, moving to Slide number 12, you have the movement dysfunction and exercise selection. So compensations and exercises to avoid if you have feet turning out. Doing calf raises may not be appropriate, okay, because the calves are already tight. You don't necessarily want to continually have them tighter. but foam rolling and stretching, that is a lot more appropriate of the calves. You can do some lengthening style dynamic stretches and dynamic movements for the calves, which could be calf raises, but to a full stretch range of motion. Knees caving in, the adductor machine and abductor machine and leg extension may not be appropriate for the knees caving in. The abductor machine would be okay because it does strengthen the outer abductors that prevent the knees from caving in, so that is okay. But the leg extension and the adductor machine might be a little bit iffy because they're already overactive. Make sure you stretch the quads, stretch the adductors for sure. Anterior pelvic tilt. The leg press, if they have an anterior pelvic tilt and they're on the leg press machine, they could arch. Might not be appropriate. Adductor machine, the adductors are most likely tight if they have an anterior pelvic tilt, so that's not appropriate. Leg raises, quads are tight, hip flexors are tight, probably not appropriate. Leg raises, the hip flexors are tight. Leg extension, the quads are probably already tight. And leg curl, though, I'm a little bit for that. The leg curl with an anterior pelvic tilt would strengthen the hamstrings. Strengthening the hamstrings helps to even out the anterior pelvic tilt, so I think that is okay. Arms falling forward. Lat pull downs and chest presses are probably not going to be most appropriate. Shoulder press, especially heavy, gets a little bit tough because they probably have rounded shoulders, which they might not be able to press something overhead too easily. All right, just a quick communication tip from NASM. It says, be transparent. And as you progress someone through any program, you want to always provide the clients with why they're doing certain exercises. That's one of my things that keeps clients very interested with my type of training is they know why they're foam rolling and stretching. They know why they're doing a certain exercise. And a lot of times it's posture. You know, like, so why is someone doing a wall angel during their warm-up? Well, they know that they have rounded shoulders, forward heads, so they're doing it to straighten that up. And I always tell them that as they go through each of the exercises to make sure they know why they're doing something and why it's important. Let's keep that in mind. All right, moving over to slide number 13. Weight loss. Specifically, a goal of the OPT model. So what you should do, according to NASM, is progress them through the OPT resistance training phases and increase metabolic demand and volume, which then increases caloric expenditure. So obviously, you're starting in phase one with weight loss. And also, to help with weight loss, increasing lean body mass works. And you're also going to want to progress the cardio stages into those zone two, zone three to increase caloric burn. But with weight loss, with NASM, they typically recommend phase one, phase two, just alternating between the two, and then working on shorter rest periods to increase the metabolic demand. That's typical. And that's all from a caloric perspective. So now more goals of the OPT model as we go to slide 14. So to increase lean body mass, NASM wants you to go through phase one through four to increase lean body mass. And you really only need to go through phase one if you don't have the coordination to do other exercises very appropriately. Otherwise, you can hang out in that 2, 3, and 4 area of the OPT model. But NASM's never gonna say start someone off in phase 3 or 4, but that is up to your discretion to make sure if they're athletic, if they've been working out for a long period of time, they look like they can handle the coordination movements of all major exercises, then it's up to you to program for them. Hypertrophy training just means increasing lean body mass, phases 1 through 4. Phase 5, you aren't really concerned with growing muscle. It's more about pushing things as fast as possible, not necessarily as heavy as possible. So that's why NASM doesn't recommend phase 5 for increasing lean body mass. That's more athletics. All right, so possibly less frequent cardio, meaning you don't want to necessarily burn a ton of calories in when you're trying to gain muscle, because those calories should be going to muscle repair. And at having extra raw materials to build muscle fiber. So maybe a little bit less cardio. And then a macronutrient nutrition recommendations for muscle growth should be made accordingly, meaning typically more protein, maybe even more carbs, or definitely NASM would say more carbs and definitely a little bit more fat, or just more calories in general. And then, obviously, you shouldn't tell them exactly how much, maybe refer them to a registered dietitian, but if they just increase their eating, they should be fine. All right, moving over to slide number 15. Improving sport performance. This is where NASM typically would recommend phases 1, 2, and 5. Now, I would probably say you want to use all phases because they all, you know, improving sport performance for most sports, you typically need to be stronger. Okay, it depends. And then most sports you need to be more coordinated. Most sports you need to have good endurance, and most sports you need to have good power. But certain sports, like a shot put, maybe less focus on the, you know, phases 1 and 2 because that's more stabilization, and more focus on that power generation or that strength generation, things like that. But you know, every sport's a little bit different. So what are the demands of the sport, and then program the phases accordingly. But NASM says 1, 2, and 5. And then if you use phase 4, only use it in off season in moderation to make sure that they gain muscle in the off season and don't over train, more or less. And then also pair high intensity cardio with non-resistance training days to avoid overtraining, meaning you would want to increase cardio to help with muscle recovery and things like that. And then muscle building athletes eat more protein. They typically recommend 0.5 to 0.8 grams per pound of body weight per day, and eat 4 to 6 smaller meals, or well, eat just eat 4 to 6 times per day, eat more frequently. That allows the protein to constantly be delivered to your muscles. Ingest carbohydrates, CHO, and protein mix within 90 minutes of a workout to increase and maximize gains, or increase recovery and maximize gains. There's a post-workout window in which your muscles are most interested in gathering nutrition, so that's why they say definitely eat within 90 minutes of a workout. All right, further goals, endurance athletes, as we move to slide 16. Endurance athletes have the greatest energy demand, and they have the most detailed and extensive nutrition plans because of it, meaning you need to eat more food because you're doing a lot longer endurance style work, and definitely increase the carbohydrates. That's and I'm going to completely agree with him. If you do endurance work, such as one of my endurance sports is surfing, I surf for longer periods of time, or even endurance running, like a longer distance running, swimming longer distances, those sorts of things, cycling, you want to increase carbohydrates because those are really good for fueling those sports. Cool. And the sports lasting longer than 4 hours requires more of carbohydrates, more carbohydrates per day, and more energy demands. And then 1.2 to 1.4 grams per kilogram of protein. So they still say increase protein as well. All right, guys, and finally, to finish up this PowerPoint lecture, we're going to talk about the session flow. So the session flow is going to be, how are you running your sessions? And this is really simple, guys. And NASM gives you a very basic template here, but you know, basically how do you want to do it is the way that you do it, but you always want to make sure you get some warm-up / foam rolling and stretching. So I always say a 10-minute warm-up is good. With my clients, we actually go full 20-minute warm-up because a lot of my clients have muscle imbalances that I want to fully take care of first. Then the next 10 minutes should be your other styles of training that are going towards their goals. So something like balance training, something like core training, something like reactive training, maybe a little bit of a jog for a further warm-up, or even a warm-up set of the certain exercises they're doing. What other types of training are you doing types of training should they be doing towards their goals? Core, balance, plyometric. And then 30 minutes of resistance training. That's the main gap. That's when your programming of the exercises works. 30 minutes of resistance training, and then a 10-minute cool down. A lot of times with my clients, I don't really have them do too much of a cool down, so our resistance training lasts typically about 30 to 40 minutes, and we get rid of that last 10-minute cool down, unless that one of their main goals is flexibility, in which we do a whole another round of stretching at the end. And then also remind the client of the outlook on the following days until their next meeting. So, hey, we aren't meeting till Thursday. I want you to get one jog in or something for homework, things like that. I skipped over it, but the pre-session, make sure everything's set up. Make sure you're ready to go. Make sure you have their program available and ready to get them through it. If they're foam rolling and stretching, set that up for them and be ready to meet them and get them started ASAP. All right, guys. Hopefully that kind of makes you a little bit more comfortable to as far as working with a client for a 1-hour session, as well as just understanding a little bit more about program design. The next three phases are going, or the next three chapters are going to be really focused in on that program design for phases one, or sorry, so we'll stage one stabilization, stage two strength, and then stage three power. That's 11, 12, and 13, the chapters there. And yeah, we'll get some more insight on that when we reach that. But for now, go ahead and listen to the audiobook lecture right below. And then go ahead and complete the assignment, and then follow through with the assignment answers, assignment audio answers, and then the quiz at the end. All right, guys, I look forward to seeing you right below with the audiobook. Until then, adios.